His mom stretched her dollars for instruments and lessons, and by 1962, the 29-year-old was the keyboard player for a band he had formed called the Paramours, the precursor to the Righteous Brothers. As his professional life soared, his marriage disintegrated. Wimber's wife, Carol, had left with their four children and planned to divorce him. But an invitation led them to a small Bible study in Yorba Linda, California, led by a 50-year-old welder named Gunner. 9 years earlier, a farmhand had tried to rape Gunner's 16-year-old daughter, Ruby, while she babysat the children of neighboring citrus growers. The boy, Billy Roop, shot Ruby in the back as she fled, killing her. The locals formed a search party. "It's lucky I found him first," Gunner said, "or the men would have killed him." Gunner forgave Billy, visited him in jail, and led him into a relationship with Christ before the state of California executed him. A columnist from the Los Angeles Times started his article on Gunner by saying, "I think I've just met my first Christian." A few months into the Bible study, John and Carol tried to pray out loud a prayer of surrender to Jesus, but they fell to the floor, sobbing and shaking. As he wept, John worried about how foolish he looked. A scene from his youth flashed in his mind. He had gone to Pershing Square in Los Angeles to borrow money from a drug dealer. As John scanned the sea of faces, a man walked by, wearing a sandwich board that read, "I'm a fool for Christ." "You sure are," thought John. As the man walked past, John saw the question on the back of the board. "Whose fool are you?" it read. Now John felt foolish for feeling foolish. "I'll be your fool the rest of my life," he promised God. John gave up his life in the music business, and two of his band members, Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley, formed their own group, the Righteous Brothers. They went on to a string of top 10 hits, some of which John had arranged. John read the Bible and loved it, especially the stories of the miracles of Jesus. He did not love church. The music was terrible, and the sermons put him to sleep. After a few months, John had only one question. "When do we get to do this stuff?" "What stuff?" the pastor asked. When the pastor figured out that John meant the healings and miracles of the Bible, he told him that Christians don't do that anymore. "Well, what do you do?" John asked. "Just what you saw this morning," said the pastor. "You mean I gave up drugs for this?" Wimber would eventually lead a small Bible study that became a Calvary Chapel church. He insisted on doing the stuff. After a while, some of the same kinds of Azusa manifestations occurred among his flock, and John had to leave the Calvary Chapel group. He joined a small group of churches called the Vineyard. John became the leader, and that little group of churches became the vanguard of a new movement of churches, the third wave of the Spirit. "Before John White left my church, he told me he had spent the last 7 months in Anaheim, California, medically documenting healings that had occurred at the Vineyard Christian Fellowship. He told me to meet the pastor, John Wimber, if I ever had the chance. He said Wimber was a good man who was committed to the scriptures and the most gifted healer he had ever seen. 2 weeks after John White left my church, Wimber flew in from California for 3 days of meetings in a Southern Baptist church in Fort Worth. After the time of singing ended, a man with white hair and a white beard with traces of red walked out onto the stage. He wore khakis, jogging shoes, and the kind of loose-fitting, untucked shirt that older men wear to conceal their weight. His face always seemed lit up like he was about to crack a joke. He reminded me of a young life leader. John shattered all my stereotypes of faith healers. He made no promises, didn't push speaking in tongues, didn't ask for money. He told crowds that others in his church were better at praying for the sick than he was. He kept no entourage to protect him from the people who swarmed around him after he spoke. He stayed for hours after the meeting laying hands on one person after another. Lisa and I introduced ourselves to Wimber after the meeting in Fort Worth. A week later, he called me from California with a warning. "Jack, you are sitting on top of a powder keg," he said. "If you go any further with healing or me, you will probably lose your church and your career at Dallas Seminary." "My course is set," I told him, "no matter what the cost." In May 1987, Wimber flew Lisa and me to Anaheim to spend a few days at the Vineyard, located in a warehouse in an industrial section of town. It was the opposite of the cathedrals I had toured in Europe that were adorned with ornate stone carvings and gold-plated statues. Long counters ran down the walls on the way to the auditorium. and behind them stood people to answer questions about the church and its many ministries. The auditorium could seat more than 3,000 people. 10 minutes before the Sunday service began, the room was already filled. I was the only person wearing a tie. Wimber played the keyboards that morning, and I felt God come into the room from the first note. People didn't merely sing. They worshipped raising their hands, which is a universal sign of surrender. They worshipped to contemporary music with simple personal lines like, "I love you, Lord." To my right, I saw a young woman fall to her knees on the front row. Tears rolled down her cheeks. She lifted up her hands. At first, I felt revulsion, and then I wondered if she was repenting like the prostitute who washed Jesus' feet with her tears. Or maybe God had simply overwhelmed her with his love. Whatever the case, in that moment, she didn't care what I or anybody else thought. I wished I could be so free. After the service, John and Carol took us out for lunch. When we pulled back into the church parking lot after lunch, hundreds of cars were still parked. I started to point him in the direction of our car, but he turned right toward it. Then he made a second turn toward it. How is it, I wondered, that he knows where we parked without me telling him? When he pulled into an empty spot near our car, a profound fear swept through me. Could he see into my soul? Then he said, "I want to take you to our bookstore and get some tapes and books for you." I laughed out loud. "What's so funny?" asked John. "We are parked right there. I thought you were supernaturally guided to our car. Carol, did you hear that? Jack knows what a holy person I am." Then everyone laughed. From its inception, no one doubted that I determined our church's direction. But all too often, leaders are too busy looking ahead to see the condition of people behind them, let alone care for them. Caring for people was Ted's specialty. Now Ted not only had to calm down people I had inflamed, but he had to argue with me about why they shouldn't be inflamed. And he had to endure me calling him a people pleaser. Over the course of a few months, I dismantled a friendship that had taken 25 years to build. I had no idea what I was doing, but Ted did. One weekend while he was away at a marriage conference in Dallas, he lamented the loss of our friendship and called me to apologize for a recent clash. "Jack, I'm so sorry for what I said to you the other day. Please forgive me." Instead of holding fast to that olive branch, I smashed it over my knee. "Ted, your disobedience to God in this matter is clear to me," I said. "You don't need to repent to me. You need to repent to God." Ted said goodbye and hung up. In their hotel, he looked at Lynn and wept. Chapter 32. In my seminary office, a student sat across from my desk and droned on about why I should accept the late assignment. Suddenly, he disappeared. I was transported to some strange place. I couldn't see him or hear him, and I had lost any awareness of my body. Then I saw the word pornography in bold black capital letters. It lasted long enough for me to realize that I hadn't concocted the trance. When I returned to my office, I took a deep breath, looked into his eyes, and blurted out, "Are you into pornography?" The look in his eyes told me he was. It also told me he was about to lie about it. "Before you say anything, I want you to know I will never tell anyone your name. You won't get into any trouble. I think the Lord has told me you're into pornography because he wants to set you free." "Yes," he said. He had picked up the habit as a teenager and never told anyone. "Can I pray for you?" I asked. I stood beside his chair and put my hand on his shoulder. I silently asked God to speak to me about this young man, as Wimber had taught me to do. "There is more here than pornography, isn't there?" I said. He lay his head on my desk and pounded it with his fist. I watched his tears run off the desk and soak into the carpet. "I'm so ashamed," he whispered. "I'm so ashamed. I'm so ashamed." Then he told me his shame. I put my hand back on his shoulder and prayed for God to set him free. He thanked me and left. That evening, as I walked past the library, he ran up to me and hugged me. "Something left me," he said. "I feel different." For 10 years after that, I received messages from him, letting me know the weight that had lifted hadn't returned. As those experiences became more frequent, my battles with Ted intensified, politicizing every decision. The elder board at Christ Chapel consisted of three pastors who graduated from Dallas Seminary and four businessmen. We had agreed not to make significant decisions unless the vote was unanimous. Now it was time to consider adding another elder. A man named Don had been nominated. He met all the criteria. Good father, good husband, knew the Bible. The vote was 6-4 and 1 against. "Jack, why can't you vote for Don?" asked the chairman. "I just don't feel right about making him an elder at this time." Everyone at the table knew it was a lie. Don's sympathies lay with Ted, not with me. His appointment would have tipped the balance of power. With such open duplicity, I did more to undermine myself than Don ever could have. By the spring of 1987, I refused to face the obvious fact that one of us would have to resign. As the founder, I envisioned building the perfect church, one that melded biblical literacy with the supernatural gifts of the Spirit and passionate worship. So at the peak of our power struggle, I invited Ted and Lynn to our house for dinner so I could have another shot to persuade him to come over to my side. Instead of wooing him with an apology, I tried to bludgeon him with fear. "I'm going to speak to crowds of people and fill stadiums," I said. "Our church will explode. You will be jealous that your unbelief in God's supernatural power kept you on the sidelines." At that moment, Ted knew our friendship had ended. What I hadn't considered was that I had also ended Lisa's relationship with Lynn. It was our last dinner. That June, I went to the church for an elder meeting at 2 in the afternoon. The first thing I noticed was that Ted was not there. Then I saw that some of the men were reluctant to look me in the eye. As I sat down, my stomach tightened. "Jack, we can't go on like this," the chairman said. "There doesn't seem to be any way to reconcile the rift in our church." I was about to tell him I agreed. And then he said, "We think you should resign." I looked at Bill, an elder who had spent hours with me praying for people, who had gone to Wimber conferences with me, who believed exactly what I believed, and who had embraced my vision of the perfect church. "Bill, do you think I should resign?" I said. "Do you agree with them?" "I do, Jack. I do," he said. "There is no other way." One of us had to go. It had come down to a choice between two men, who up until that point had perfectly complemented each other. One always wanted to chart a bold course, but frequently confused courage with pride and ignored all the wounds he inflicted. The other cared for people, but he could care too much about what they thought. A leader or a pastor? I can say this now. I couldn't then. They chose wisely. Chapter 33. At the start of my 11th year of teaching, a student sat across from my desk and leveled an insult that I would never have uttered as a student. "Dr. Deer, you are ruining the course," he said. "You obviously know all the material, but you are shortchanging us. You are far too devotional in class. I go to church for my spiritual life. I come to your Old Testament introduction course to learn how to fight against the liberals." He was right. I had become the kind of professor I despised as a student, but I couldn't help it. I had lost the desire to teach languages my students would never use and tactics for a war with the liberals they would never fight. No one in my church ever asked me whether Moses wrote the first 5 books of the Bible or if it was some scribe or scribal school that compiled the Torah in the 5th century BCE. And yet, I had to convince my students that they should know the ins and outs of each side of the argument. I should have been happy. I still love languages and academic theology. I had tenure. I could teach any class I wanted. The library would purchase any book I wanted. The only papers I had to grade were master's theses and doctoral dissertations. My job was effortless. As I learned more about the gifts, the one I saw the least examples of was prophecy, the supernatural ability to predict the future and reveal things hidden in the present. Then in the fall of 1987, I spoke at a Presbyterian church in Kansas City. A man in the audience punctuated my points with shouts of glory. After the meeting, we met. "I'm Mike Bickle," said the 33-year-old leader of the Kansas City Prophets. He was built like a short, powerful fullback who ran over linebackers, and he had a deep, resonant voice. Mike had wanted to go to Dallas Seminary, but he had to drop out of college to care for his brother Pat, who had broken his neck in a high school football game, and was now a quadriplegic. "Would you like to meet some of our prophetic people in the morning?" Mike asked. "Sure," I said. Wimber had warned me earlier about the company Bickle kept. "I know those guys, Jack. I like Mike Bickle. But those prophets are nothing special. God gave you a good mind. Don't go up there and get deceived." At 8 o'clock the next morning, Lisa and I, along with five of our friends from Fort Worth, walked into a small room in the basement of the church. At the door, I met a 6-foot-tall man with a full salt-and-pepper beard and deep-set, spooky eyes. "Oh, I didn't expect to see you here this morning," he said. Already, I did not like him. "What do you mean?" I said. "I don't even know you." "Well, I know you. I saw you in a dream 8 nights ago. I thought it was important, so I wrote it down. Would you like me to tell you what the Lord showed me about you?" "Sure," I said. 12 of us sat in a circle in orange plastic chairs that clashed with the bright green carpet. "Your father dropped the ball on you," he said. "True, but he could have found that out with just a little research. You were in a conflict. You think that there are only 3 people on your side, but there are 5 more on your side you don't know about. Only Lisa knew about this conflict and the 3 people on my side." Now he had my attention, but my expression remained flat. "When you were young, God gave you athletic ability, but he allowed you to be frustrated in the use of that ability, so you would channel all your energy into building an intellectual kingdom," he said. "You're at the top of your kingdom now, and you are heartsick. All this frustration has been necessary for you to fulfill the assignment that God has for your life." Those words overwhelmed me, but all he saw was a blank stare on my face. "You have a prayer. It's actually the dream of your heart," he said. Then he told me the prayer I prayed that morning in our hotel room, the prayer I prayed every morning. He said, "God said to tell you that dream is from him, and he'll answer your prayer." Inside, I cried. It took every bit of self-control I had to hold on to that blank stare as my mind reeled and my heart raced. "Thanks," I said. After the meeting, Mike asked, "Was anything that John Paul said true?" "Every bit of it was true. But your face said none of it was true." I told him I had been warned. That year, I attended Vineyard conferences around the country, John Pate, Lisa's, and My Way. After an evening session at a conference in Ohio, I stood next to John to watch him while he answered questions and prayed for people. A young woman asked me, "Are you with him?" "Yes," I said. "Would you give this to him?" she asked as she handed me a note. "Sure, what does it say?" I asked. She told me she was born with a split spinal cord. Dia stomata myelia, in doctor speak. At 29, she was scheduled for surgery to repair the condition. The surgery could have paralyzed her or even taken her life. Wimber prayed for her 9 months earlier at a conference in San Diego. When she went back to the doctor, she had one spinal cord. A line of at least 2 dozen people stretched out from John. She knew he was tired and didn't want to bother him. She wanted him to know that God had healed her. At midnight, John and I sat in a restaurant eating chili, coleslaw, and French fries. I tried to give him the note. "What does it say?" he asked. I told him. "Oh, I remember her." "That's great," he said, and took another bite of coleslaw and didn't mention it again. At the time, most conservative evangelicals believed that the charismatic gifts described in Scripture had ceased. To some, the third wave movement resembled an infection, and I was now at a key entry point. If someone like Wimber could dupe a tenured professor at Dallas Theological Seminary into believing in the gifts, no one was safe. The ecclesiastical power brokers were nervous, and in October 1987, they convinced Don Campbell, the seminary's third president, to apply the pressure. "Jack, 9 out of the last 10 days, I've had calls from our constituency complaining about you," Campbell told me over lunch. "Calls from within the country and even from outside the country. People want to know how I can continue to let you remain on the faculty when you are so obviously in sympathy with a man like John Wimber." "You're between a rock and a hard place," I said, "and I'm sorry to be the cause of it." The next month, Campbell gave me a choice: renounce my friendship with Wimber or resign from Dallas Seminary. After that interview, a 2-page memo appeared in our faculty boxes. The second page was titled, "Implications for the Faculty of the Doctrinal Statements Article on spiritual gifts and the charismatic movement. From that time on, the faculty had to segregate themselves, not only from charismatics, but also from charismatic-type people. The memo was not signed. The fifth implication of the doctrinal statement was aimed at me. Faculty members are expected to avoid promoting, on or off campus, charismatic or charismatic type practices, persons, or movements. I had never mentioned Wimber's name on campus, but my friendship with him off campus was considered promoting a charismatic type person. We all knew what a charismatic was, but what was a charismatic type? It was John Wimber. Presumably, it was also me. While I was a professor, I had been friends with alcoholics and agnostics, addicts and attorneys, atheists and adulterers, and even the owner of a liquor store. But now my friendship with a charismatic type Christian had put the purity of Dallas Seminary at risk. I was given 30 days to renounce Wimber or resign. When my time ran out, I walked into Don Campbell's office. "I will not resign," I said. "I will not renounce Wimber. I leave the matter in your hands. Do what you think will please God. I will not contest your decision." Dr. Campbell fired me for doctrinal deviation, not for a deviant friendship. My last day at the seminary was December 18, 1987. 22 years earlier, on December 18th, God had found me in a bedroom in the middle of the night in a little house on the east side of Fort Worth. How odd. I came home that Friday evening, adrift for the first time in 22 years. My well-defined life was gone. Wimber was right. It was a powder keg. Our dining room glowed in candlelight. Lisa had set the table for one of her French dinners. New friends would be joining us. At my seat, Lisa had placed our three local newspapers, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Dallas Morning News, and the Dallas Times-Herald. I was mentioned by name in each one of them, and cast as David versus the institutional Goliath. Before dinner, a friend called to say he had prayed for me that morning. Haggai 2, 18 and 19 popped into his mind. When we hung up, I turned to Haggai 2, verses 18 and 19, which read, "From this day on, from this 24th day of the ninth month, from this day on, I will bless you." I went into the study and pulled a biblical chronology book off the shelf. I looked up Haggai's 24th day of the ninth month. It was 520 B.C., December 18th. Now I understood. None of this had been an accident. Chapter 34. In May 1988, I attended a conference in Greenville, South Carolina, where Mike Bickle spoke on passion for Jesus. Until that message, I had never heard the phrase, passion for Jesus. I had never prayed for my feelings. If I thought about my feelings at all, it was about a strategy to defeat them. Mike stood on a stage that night, with no notes, only an open Bible. In his reverberant voice, he told us that the Apostle John was Jesus' best friend, who only referred to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And in that love, John found his identity and his self-worth, not in his service. Mike had more authority than any teacher I had ever heard. He did not proclaim a doctrine he had studied. He revealed the power of a truth that lived in him. I wanted the spiritual life I saw in him. I wanted his passion for God. I hadn't felt that way about anyone since Scott Manley had been yanked out of my life. Mike read John 17, verse 26 to us, where Jesus prayed, "Father, I have made you known to them," that is, the apostles, "and I will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them." It takes God to love God, Mike said. I had never heard anyone say it like that. Then he turned the verse into his own prayer. "Father, grant me a work of the Holy Spirit to love the Son of God like you love him." A prayer that was too profound not to steal. I have uttered it every night since then. We moved to Anaheim, California in September 1988, and I joined the staff of the Vineyard Christian Fellowship of Anaheim. John bought us a four-bedroom home about 20 minutes from the church and remodeled it to our taste. Not long after we moved in, Scott and I were alone in the house on a Saturday. At lunchtime, I came out of my bedroom where I had been reading. As I walked down the hall, I heard Scott talking to someone. I stopped to eavesdrop on Scott and this mystery guest. I heard a high-pitched voice say, "Please, don't cut me." "I have to cut you," said Scott. "You're going on my sandwich." "No, please," begged the tomato. "Just take the lettuce instead." Then my aspiring ventriloquist let out a sound like a piglet ripped away from its mother. "Lettuce, you're next," announced Scott, intoning the executioner. "You don't want me," said the lettuce. "I'm wilted." "Liar, I'm ripping you." The lettuce screamed its last scream. Then the bread begged not to be smothered with mayonnaise. I would have laughed out loud, but I wanted to keep listening. He kept up the charade until he took the first bite of his ham and cheese sandwich. If you wanted a detailed explanation of the structure of the Book of Acts, you wouldn't get it at the Vineyard. But if you spent time at John's church, you would see glimpses of how Christians in that day lived. Thousands of volunteers prayed for the sick, cared for the poor and homeless, served prisoners and their families, and gathered in homes each week to celebrate their experiences of God together and to love one another. John took me all over the world for Vineyard conferences. He put me on a stage in front of thousands and introduced me to key leaders in a host of far-flung countries. At the time, I took his generosity for granted, believing that I had earned the platform he provided. Yet I still looked up to him. When I debated a prominent theologian in front of 500 of his students, John showed up to watch. My opponent had already prejudged me. He thought I believed tongue-speaking was the essential ingredient to a deep spiritual life, and that God wanted to heal everyone. I surprised him when I told him I did not believe those things. Then he made a critical biblical error, exposing his jugular. Years earlier, I could not have passed up the opportunity. But as I pondered the prospect of humiliating him, I realized that I had a choice: win the debate or win a potential friend. I chose the latter, and I began to treat the event more like a discussion than a fencing match. After the debate, he invited me to give lectures to his students. Afterward, John, Lisa, and I rode home together. "Jack," he said, "I am proud of you. You were great tonight. You were kind." I felt the same way I did after Scott Manley told me I'd done an excellent job telling my story. Scott had never done well in school. He couldn't sit still and routinely wound up in the classrooms of the most rigid teachers. At the small elementary school near our home, the principal suspended him several times, once for egging the building during Christmas break. We found another place for him, a specialized learning center that recognized not all students flourish in the same kind of environment. His teacher loved him, but he brought her to tears. While Lisa and I ministered at lengthy Vineyard services and conferences, Stephen and Scott would hang out with the church receptionist at the front desk. One played a guitar and gave Stephen free lessons. Another had been stabbed while he served as a missionary on the streets of Hollywood. Another studied to be a chiropractor and regaled the boys with stories about how individual vertebrae affected the different parts of the body. During a conference one night, the would-be chiropractor pulled me aside. "Jack, I just saw Scott, and he was high." "How do you know he was high?" I asked. "He was glassy-eyed and a little out of it." "Scott's always a little out of it, but he wouldn't smoke marijuana," I said. "Jack, all I can tell you is that I used to get high," he said. "He's definitely high." I had never taken drugs. I didn't even know what marijuana smelled like. I didn't consider that familiarity breeds recognition, nor that the receptionist had no motive to exaggerate or lie to one of his bosses. About an hour later, Scott found me in the foyer. "Dad, Bob said I was high on pot," Scott said. "Why would he say that? You know I'd never do pot." "I don't know, Scott. Don't worry, I didn't believe him." It was the kind of brilliant preemptive strike that I would continue to witness as Scott grew. He couldn't perform long division to save his life, but he intuitively understood a pillar truth of crisis communications. The best way to kill a story is to tell it without being asked. Chapter 35. On the weekends, I followed John's three sons into the Mojave Desert. I brought my pistols, rifles, and shotguns, and offered advice on shooting. They brought their motorcycles and taught my sons how to traverse canyons. I spent the evenings before Christmas of 1991 shopping for dirt bikes for my boys. One night I came home to find Lisa inconsolable, holding her face in her hands. She couldn't speak or even look up. Elise had one arm around her mom. "What happened?" I asked. She told me that earlier that night, Scott had a nosebleed. Lisa tried to get him to tilt his head back and put pressure on it with a rag. He just wanted to let it bleed into a cup while he watched TV. They argued, the cup was knocked over, and Scott raged. He called Lisa something a son should never say to his mother. "Where is he?" I asked. "In his bedroom," Elise said. When I threw open Scott's bedroom door, he jumped off his waterbed. I grabbed my 13-year-old son by his shirt and lifted him off the floor, his head level with my head. "What did you call your mother?" I yelled. "Dad, please." "Dad? You call my wife a mother effer, and you think you can call me dad?" I yelled. I threw him on his waterbed. I never hurt him physically, but I wanted him to think I was going to hurt him. Then I pronounced him indefinitely grounded. I forgot all about my own story of the damn shittin' rat, the back room, and my dad's mercy. Publicly, John was always gracious, even to his critics, but he could be cranky with his inner circle. He complained that I spent too much of the church's money on books or long-distance phone calls when we were out of the country. It irked John when I acted more like a partner than a subordinate, like the time I took my family on a 3-week vacation to Hawaii without asking John or telling anyone else how long I would be gone. He had made me a household name in congregations all over the country. I was the chief theologian in a movement of more than 500 churches. As usual, I tended to discount all those gifts. And as time revealed more of John's flaws, I turned into the rebellious son, provoking my spiritual father to fury behind closed doors. Sometimes he devastated me, but we always apologized after a day or two. As my fourth year with John ran out, so did our patience for one another. The subject of our breaking point was silly, where I planned to spend my vacation. A handful of the Vineyard's top leaders had acquired John's love of food along with his love of people. I was one of them. However, I longed for the 32-inch waist I'd had when we returned from Europe 6 years earlier. A wealthy businessman in the church offered me a free month in Santa Monica at what was essentially a fat camp for rich people. John forbade me to go. I never learned the real reason, but the Anaheim Vineyard was in the middle of a fundraising campaign for a new building. I assumed he just wanted my fat camp money. But I couldn't say that. I called him controlling. He blew up. And when I made it clear that I had been inoculated to his anger, he made it clear that I had to go. I spent my last days as a California resident, running 14 miles a day up and down the beach, and pretending to enjoy food stripped of salt and fat. In May 1992, Lisa put Elise and two Cocker Spaniels, Missy and Susie May, into a Camry, and I put Stephen and Scott into a Suburban, and we drove the cars that John had bought us back to the city of my birth. My name remained prominent in the movement John had created, and among other churches where he had given me a platform. Speaking invitations poured in. I worked on a book. 5 months after we returned to Fort Worth, I picked up a ringing phone in the home we had rented. I was shocked to hear the voice on the other end. It was John. "Jack, I'm so sorry," he said. "I did not want our first call to be like this. I just found out that a youth worker sexually molested Scott and another pastor's son." The worker's name was Chris. He was a 30-year-old financial advisor with no knowledge of finance, no money, and the maturity of a high school kid. After the phone call, I went into Scott's room. "Scott, I just talked to John Wimber," I said. "He told me about Chris. It's very important that you don't lie to me now." "Okay," said Scott. "What did you and Chris do?" "Everything but kiss." I had counseled men who had been molested as preteens and teens. I knew how sexual assault created sexual confusion. I told Scott it wasn't his fault. He had been taken advantage of. I couldn't tell if he believed me. On Sundays, we attended Restoration, a church of more than 2,000 near Fort Worth. At the conclusion of a Sunday service, the pastor, Doug White, said he thought God had spoken to him about someone in the audience. "There is a young man here today who thinks he has AIDS, but you don't," White said. "Satan is lying to you." Later that afternoon, Scott said to me, "Dad, I was the young man. I feel free now." Chapter 36. Although Scott had been delivered from the fear of AIDS, some unnamed affliction still clung to him. Lisa found marijuana in his sock drawer. Then she got a phone call that he had been arrested trying to run across a freeway. The police had found a gun on the friend he was with at the time. Just before his 16th birthday, we hired a psychologist to test him. Poor ego strength, poor academics, poor attention, poor impulse control, excessive suffering, excessive aggressiveness, and poor social conformity, the psychologist wrote in her evaluation. Scott's writing was on a fourth grade level, a trail of words sometimes scrawled in cursive, sometimes in print, with no indication of why he switched from one to the other. He stated that he would like to be a doctor when he grows up, she wrote. He thinks he has the most trouble with schoolwork and would like to change himself so that he would be smarter. Her diagnosis of Scott? Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Adjustment Disorder with Mixed Disturbance of Emotions and Conduct. Developmental Disorder of Written Expression. The psychologist recommended placing Scott in a remedial school and that he continue with counseling. She secured him a prescription of Ritalin, round little white pills prescribed to treat ADHD. At first, he thrived on the drug, waking at 6 a.m. to focus on his schoolwork. But before long, he abused the medication. I was still angry at John, so angry that I wrote him out of my first book. Jack, you cannot write about your life and leave John out, said a professor who read an early draft. I don't know what happened between you two, but it would be disrespectful and dishonest. So I found a few kind words to say and put him back in the story where he belonged. But I would not let him back into my heart. In the fall of 1993, an old Young Life friend of mine called from Whitefish, Montana, to ask if I wanted to pastor the First Presbyterian Church of Whitefish, where he served as an elder. I told him I wasn't interested, but then Lisa reminded me of several dreams she had had over the last 5 years about us living in Whitefish. I remembered the tiny town in the northwest corner of the state from when we vacationed there in the early 1980s. It was an outdoorsman's paradise. I could not imagine living in a small town without an international airport. But by now, I had an immense respect for Lisa's dreams. She had dreamed about us moving to Anaheim to be with John Wimber when I had no desire to move there and instead thought I should start a church in Dallas. Before we ever left for Anaheim, she dreamed we would be there 4 years and leave over a conflict, and that is exactly what happened. Lisa was ready to go to Whitefish as soon as my friend extended the offer. I prayed about it for 4 months, and then we made plans to move to Whitefish. I had no idea why God moved us to Whitefish, but I saw some immediate benefits. My Sunday morning stage was small, but the hunting was spectacular. I believe Scott would have a harder time finding freeways to cross and drugs to take in a town of 3,000 people. That latter belief shows how little I knew about drugs. We moved into a house on the side of a mountain that overlooked a bright green meadow and a glacial lake that sparkled in the sunlight. Beyond them, one mountain after another rippled north all the way to Canada. Jagged peaks that were home to bears, moose, deer, mountain lions, coyotes, and more bird species than you could name. From our deck, I watched golden eagles fly over the trees with squirrels clutched in their talons. The church swelled in attendance from 170 to more than 300 in my first year as pastor. From a per capita standpoint, we had become a megachurch. A tenth of the city turned out on Sunday morning. People in the church said, "God brought you here to lead our church into revival." I was surprised to find out that not all members of the church felt the same way. When four elderly women invited me for tea and cake one afternoon, I assumed they wanted to thank me. Instead, they told me that all the new young people ruined their church. They hated the music. We sang half contemporary worship songs and half classic hymns. They wanted their hymns back and nothing but their hymns. "Ladies, I love the hymns too," I said. "But we have a lot of young people who love contemporary worship music. Should we just ignore the worship songs that are meaningful to them?" "That music is not Presbyterian," they said. "Those young people are not Presbyterian. Some have only attended here for 10 years. We've been here for more than 40 years. I tried to sympathize with their tiny, frozen hearts. Before we left for Montana, Mom had moved in with my sister Debbie and her physician husband just outside of town on a horse ranch. Bobby, Mom's best and only friend, stayed at her side and came to work each day. After we left for Whitefish, Mom lost interest in her grandkids. I brought the boys from Montana to hunt doves in Texas in September 1995, but Mom did not care to see them. When Mom began wandering off from home, Debbie was forced to put her in a nursing home. My brother Gary called me in Montana the next year. "If you want to talk to Mom one last time," he said, "you better get back here quick. Her mind is going." I did not go home. A year after we relocated in Whitefish, I sat in my study praying when an unsought picture of me provoking John floated across my mind. "Lord," I said, "was I really like that?" A cascade of uglier scenes came and went. Over the next few days, I could not stop thinking about John. I picked up the phone. "I'll be in California in a couple of weeks," I said. "Could we get together?" "Sure," said John. "I'll be glad to see you, Jack." John had limped into his 60s, cancer, stroke, heart attack. Carol answered the door and then walked me back to the kitchen, where John had parked his wheelchair in front of the breakfast table. The afternoon sun beamed through the glass patio doors, highlighting a person whose friendship had cost me my academic career. It was a small price to pay for the priceless education he had given me. His once bulky cheeks had hollowed out a little, but his jovial expression was still intact. In his lap, he held a bucket for the unpredictable nausea with which he was consigned to live out his days. "Well," I said, "it's been 3 years. Neither of us have said a negative word about the other." "I know," he said, "we've been very disciplined in our bitterness." My heart broke. No one could use humor to cut through the lies and go right to the heart of an issue like John. "John, I came to ask you to forgive me. Not just for the way I left, but for throwing away our friendship." "But Jack, I hurt." I raised my hand to cut him off. "No, John, please don't say it. You would never have hurt me had I not repeatedly provoked you. 1,000 young men would have given their right hands to be your right hand, but you picked me. I stand on stages around the world now. I have written a book that is selling all over the world. None of this would have happened without you being a father to me. I have been supremely ungrateful." That was as far as I got before tears brought me to the ground at John's feet. He put his right hand on my shoulder. "I forgive you, Jack," he said. In stillness, I had sought God. He had visited me with a picture I did not want to see, because it reveals so much ugliness in me. But in the discomfort of that light, gifts abounded. The strength to give up a grudge, the humility to ask for forgiveness, and the sensation of being loved, but not holy. As I walked from John's house to my rental car, I felt lighter, as though something evil had left me. Chapter 37. Raised by a single mom over a bar in Wolf Point, Montana, Benny B. grew up drinking and fighting. When his first marriage failed, his two boys went to live with him, and he taught them how to fight. He told them the secret to winning. It doesn't hurt to get hit. He was short but strong. When I met him, he was trying to shed the thick layer of fat that encased his muscles. Benny jumped out of bed every morning without an alarm at 4:30, and though he never attended college, he managed to acquire 3 radio stations in Montana. He had been a Christian for 4 years when we arrived in Whitefish. In church, I saw him cry during hymns and sermons. We worked out every afternoon at the gym together. Others from our church joined us, even women in their 60s. The children came too. It was our version of a healthy cocktail hour. Benny's wife, Coco, a devout Christian who served on the city council, had beaten cancer 5 years earlier. One afternoon in the late summer, Lisa and Coco went hiking together at the local ski resort. Lisa returned downcast. Coco hadn't had a recent test, but Lisa said she knew, she just knew, the cancer was back. Through no fault of his own, Benny was the spark that ignited a conflict in the congregation I had agreed to lead. A vacancy opened on the church's elder board, and I nominated him for it. Another elder raised questions about his suitability for the job. She said she had heard from one of his employees that he managed his workers harshly. I thought the criticism was unfair, and I told her so. Benny wound up on the board, but the disagreement sowed tremendous discord. That year, I invited the Bees to a conference at a church in North Carolina along with our family. I wanted to have as many people as possible lay hands on Coco and pray for her healing, especially people who actually believe that God might heal her. Scott went to the conference with us. As Scott walked through the sanctuary after a meeting, he caught the attention of a longtime Nashville studio musician. Don Potter arranged music for the Judds. He was the leader of their band and had co-produced their albums and written 3 or 4 of their songs. He lived with his wife, Christine, in Adams, Tennessee, northwest of Nashville, next to a Christian camp. When he watched Scott pass by, he saw a younger version of himself. Then he heard a voice say, "This boy is a time bomb, and he will go off at the most inopportune moment." After the conference ended, Don invited Scott to his home. It was the summer of 1995, and the popularity of grunge music had begun to wane. Scott, however, was still immersed in it, but the distorted, down-tuned riffs and angst-drenched lyrics of the genre grated on the ears of one of country music's most celebrated guitar players. "How does it make you feel after you listen to it?" he asked Scott. Trying to free Scott of bad influences, Don introduced him to B.B. King, and Scott was mesmerized by King's fast-twitch vibrato and liquid guitar string bends. Scott told Don he had done pot, ecstasy, and other chemicals Don had never heard of. He also revealed a deep-rooted inadequacy. "I can never be a great man," Scott said. "My dad is great in every way." Scott confided that he wanted to kill the youth worker who had sexually assaulted him. How could someone he loved and trusted and looked up to as a spiritual leader betray him like that? But the confusion that the abuse created tormented him more than anything. Was he gay? Was he straight? How could he ever know? That summer, I organized the whole church to fast and pray for Coco and for anyone else who was sick. The first round of chemotherapy almost killed Coco. She refused a second round. People said to me, "Now we know why God brought you here, Jack, so Coco can be healed." I sat with Benny for hours in Coco's bedroom every day and prayed for God to heal her. Some days, Benny and I fell asleep on the floor beside her. Coco kept right on dying. In Tennessee, Don made Scott a counselor at the Christian camp adjacent to their farm. The kids loved him. Scott loved them back. He also loved the pet deer that the Potters kept, and he loved driving their John Deere tractor. "Do you know the gospel?" Don asked Scott. "Yeah, I know the words," Scott said. They prayed together and cried together, and Scott asked Don to baptize him. One evening, Don lowered my son's head into a river, and when he lifted him back up, Scott looked more peaceful and confident than ever. Don wanted to ask Scott to live with Christine and him indefinitely. He knew Scott needed someone to walk with him, but he worried that his offer might offend me. Who is he to offer such help to the son of a great man? So Scott returned to Whitefish. He dated Cassie, Benny and Coco's daughter. Someone from the police force called Benny and said, "Your daughter rides around with that preacher son, breaking every speed limit in town." Benny laughed when he told me. Don and Christine came to visit. Don brought his guitar. I took them over to the Bees, and the man who had played on more than 100 #1 hit records serenaded Coco with worship songs in her bedroom. With her last strength, Coco raised her arms to God, offering him whatever she had left. She stopped eating. On September 15, 1995, Coco lay at home in a hospital bed surrounded by her friends and family. She slipped into a coma. At 9:30, the death rattle gurgled in her throat. I kissed her goodnight, not goodbye. I planned to be back at dawn. At 2:30 a.m., Coco's sister called. "Jack, could you come over now?" I could hear Benny weeping in the background. When I pulled up, Benny was standing on the front porch waiting for me, crying. "I never thought she would die," he said. "I never thought she would die. I never thought she would die, Jack." I hugged him. Then I bounded up the stairs 2 at a time. It wasn't over yet. I held Coco's hand. It was still warm, but she wasn't breathing. "Please, God. Please, God." It didn't work. So I put my arms around her and commanded death to give Coco back. That didn't work either. The darkness overpowered my faith. It paralyzed me. The words I prayed dribbled out of my mouth and ran down my chin and fell on the floor. We had Coco's funeral on Monday. The whole town was there. Benny and I stood beside Coco's grave on a cold, overcast day. I said the last prayer, and the rain fell. I was empty of hope. I couldn't find any meaning in this story. All I could offer was a loving arm to put around Benny and the words, "Let's get out of here." In the months that followed, I kept seeing Coco in her bed, arms stretched up to heaven. What is more supernatural, a healing or a heart that still worships as cancer ravaged the body in which it beat? I could not say. I just wanted a heart like that. Chapter 38. 4 months before Scott turned 18, he enrolled in Master's Commission, a full-time Christian discipleship school that churches all over the country hosted. Scott went to the school at the church in Kansas City founded by my friend Mike Bickle. The school created a structured environment for undisciplined and directionless young people stuck in that vast gray area between adolescence and adulthood. Volunteer host families from the church put up the students from around the world. The school placed Scott and another boy named Mark with Doc and Nancy Fletcher. At first, they shared a bedroom, but Scott's messiness exasperated Mark, so Doc and Nancy put the boys in separate bedrooms. To the Fletchers, Scott seemed like a big Labrador puppy that bounced from person to person in search of a hug. While Mark tiptoed around the house, Scott bounded down the stairs with such force that he shook the pictures on the wall. Claiming that he was a germaphobe, Scott refused to clean the church's toilets, a job other students did without complaint. To teach them how to budget, the school limited the amount of cash students could receive each month. But I had given Scott a credit card in case of emergencies. Scott routinely used it to invite friends to lunch. "How about we go out to lunch on Jack Deere?" he would say. He made sure everyone knew I was his father. And when Doc and Scott visited bookstores, Scott would find my books and create his own display on the bestseller table. Whenever he made a mistake, Scott stuck out his thumb and forefinger in the shape of an L on his forehead and mouthed the word, "loser." It was a side of him we never saw. To us, he could appear charming and confident, shiftless and defiant, but never self-loathing. And so we never saw that L on his forehead. Instead, we saw a big question mark. Would he ever change? And if not, what then? After 2 years in Whitefish, the conflict over Benny B. joining the Elder Board ballooned into a war between the people who wanted to create a different church experience and those who clung to the past. A former member who had helped recruit me threatened to turn me into the IRS, and soon after I received a letter from the government that I had been selected for what proved to be a fruitless but time-consuming audit. The vocal minority in the church launched a campaign with the regional presbytery to have me removed from the pulpit. Rather than fight that battle, I resigned. So did all the elders. But I had no intention of leaving Whitefish. I had become close friends with perhaps the best bow hunter in the state, Terry Van Dyken. In the fall, I followed him on horseback into the mountains in search of elk. At the end of a 4-day hunting trip for elk or a day's hunt for deer, I spent happy evenings in Terry and Vanessa's small home, reliving our hunting exploits. I grew to love their teenage sons, all of whom were excellent hunters. The Van Dykens were one of the reasons that Montana had become a paradise for me. On another dove hunting trip to Texas, I finally decided to visit Mom in her rest home. It smelled of urine and decaying flesh, like the rest home I had worked in as a teenager. I found her shuffling down the hall, half moaning and half babbling. "Hi, Mom." She stared at me. Her eyes flickered with recognition that quickly disappeared. Someone had hacked off her hair. It looked awful. Maybe she had done it to herself. She was overweight and gray, and her cheeks sagged. I took her hand and led her to Lisa, who threw her arms around Mom. But Mom didn't seem to know who Lisa was anymore. I wanted her to sit down, but Mom wanted to lap the halls. So we walked. Lisa held Mom's hand and squeezed it. Mom smiled at her and squeezed back. Then an old woman shuffled by us, going the opposite way. "She's a bitch," said Mom. "Mom, don't talk like that," I scolded her. "Well, she is a bitch. Mom, please." Every person we passed was a bitch or worse. I told her to stop one too many times, and that scared her. And she disappeared into the shell that kept her on the earth. Finally, she sat down on a sofa. I drew up a chair 2 feet opposite her. I looked into the eyes of the woman who made a fighter out of me, and I searched for any hint of her essence that might still linger in the body that used to be so beautiful. Maybe those grumbles and curses were all that was left inside. We stared silently at each other for the longest time. Nothing. Tears rolled down my cheeks. I broke our silence. "Mom, do you miss Dad?" Her face turned sweet and sad. Her eyes looked into mine. "Yes," she said. "Me too," I said back. And then she was gone. Lisa and I did not speak in the car. I knew I had seen Mom for the last time. I had waited too long to say goodbye. At Doc and Nancy's house, Scott looked out the window every 5 minutes whenever any of us came to visit. When the doorbell rang, he ran to greet us. Doc expected to see an embrace. Instead, as soon as he opened the door, all the excitement drained out of Scott, and it seemed as though an 18-inch barrier had been placed between him and us. As his graduation from the Master's Commission neared, he was told to write how he had changed that year. He typed out a one-paragraph summary with words randomly capitalized and sentences with misplaced punctuation. "Change comes slow," he wrote. "Change comes hard, but change does come. This year has been about dying to the self and choosing to do that every day." Perhaps he was sincere, but he also wrote a parody of the assignment to a friend as if he were addressing students who would attend the school the next year. "Dear class of 96-97, this is Scott Deere to tell you everything there is to know about Master's Commission. Firstly, don't drink and drive the first few weeks. This will get you into trouble. Also, you need to heed the don't murder while angry ethic, though you may be tempted at times. Enjoy a few beers, but don't go too far. Most importantly, make sure to have some good excuses ready. No ravaging of girls is allowed, so cut it out. That is all I have to say about that. Goodbye and good luck, Scott." Scott came home to Whitefish, ungrateful and surly. He slept in until noon and refused to work. I let it go on for a few months. Then I worried that by giving him free food and a place to stay, I compounded the problem. When I told him he needed to leave, Scott said he wanted to go back to Kansas City. I bought him a plane ticket and gave him $700 to get started. He talked Doc and Nancy into putting him up. He worked at a Mexican restaurant and got in a car wreck with his co-workers, all of whom were high. Everyone suffered broken bones except Scott. The restaurant fired him after it became clear he would always struggle with basic tasks, like remembering to refill water glasses. He worked at a record store for a short time and then drove a street sweeper in mall parking lots at night. Doc and Nancy learned about Scott's drug use and gave him an ultimatum. "You can live with us," they said, "but you can't do drugs." "Well, I guess I'm moving out," Scott said. That October 1997, I appeared with John Wimber on a Christian TV show. He had to hold my arm for support as we stood in front of the camera. A month later, an artery burst in his brain, killing him. Lisa and I flew to Anaheim. I was asked to write a tribute to John's life to be published after the funeral. I took out the hotel stationery, and tears poured out of my eyes, rivulets washing the words away. Lisa came up behind me and put her hand on my shoulder and said, "Oh, honey." I could not stop crying. I could now see the beauty and the greatness of God and the spiritual father I had spurned. But it took his death for me to realize it, and now I would never see him again. Scott moved in with his aunt, Lisa's former sister-in-law, Penny, who lived in Kansas City with her two children. He lasted there a few months before he was asked to leave. After that, he drove to Fort Worth, where he still had plenty of friends. But before long, Scott called me. He said he was having a nervous breakdown and wanted to come home. If I would send him food and gas money, he would drive to Montana. I should have put him on a plane, for it was more likely that he was in withdrawal rather than suffering a nervous breakdown. Instead, I sent him $300 through a friend in Fort Worth. 400 miles later, Scott wrecked his car. He hadn't been arrested, and his car was still drivable, but he was a basket case. I told him to drive to Colorado Springs, and I'd have another friend put him on a plane to Whitefish. Scott arrived in Montana a few weeks before my speaking engagements in Portland and San Jose. I took him with me, along with Lisa and Elise. Being on his own had made him worse. He offended our host in Portland and terrified Elise. who locked herself in the bathroom of our hotel room. I didn't know what drugs he was taking, but he had to be taking something. We checked into an expensive hotel in San Jose, and I called him to my room to talk to him alone.